This week on World Affairs, has the United States really averted war with Iran? The U.S. and Iran may have taken a step back from the brink, but experts still believe that the two nations are as close to war than at any time since the hostage crisis in 1979, and that a mistake like the apparent downing of the Ukrainian commercial airline in Iran could spark an all-out conflict that no one really wants. Hello. I'm Philip Yun, CEO of World Affairs. In this episode, we look at the circumstances that led to the American killing of Iran's top general and the Iranian missile attack on U.S. assets inside Iraq. What are the strategic implications for Iran, the Middle East, and the world? World Affairs is produced in partnership with KQED, and it's made possible by the generous support of Chevron and TPG. And now to Ray Suarez in Washington.
Joining us in studio is Vali Nasser. He's a professor of Middle East Studies at Johns Hopkins University and author of The Shia Revival. He was a senior advisor in the State Department in the Obama administration. Barbara Slavin is a veteran Middle East journalist and now directs the Future of Iran initiative at the Atlantic Council. She's author of Bitter Friends, Bosom Enemies, Iran, the U.S., and the Twisted Path to Confrontation. And from Baghdad, for the first part of the program, we're joined by Jane Aaraf, international correspondent for National Public Radio. Welcome to you all. Jane, let's start with you. We are recording this on Friday, January 10th, and obviously circumstances can always change, and very quickly in this particular story. But what's the mood on the ground in Iraq? I understand you've just come from a demonstration. What are people saying?
I have, and it's really worrying. I mean, as you know, Iraq has been through a lot. But the people at that demonstration, those are the ones generally who were children when Saddam Hussein was removed. And so all they've ever known really is war and conflict, and this is looking even worse. As for officials, I mean, this really is a pivotal time for Iraq. You've got a country where Iran and Iranian militias are the strongest probably that they've been since Saddam was toppled in 2003. You've got the U.S. that could or could not be leaving after the Iraqi parliament voted to have the troops ordered to leave. So almost everything here is up in the air, and it's contributing to this real feeling of uncertainty and a real concern about whether this could in fact get even worse.
Do the people that you've been speaking to feel some anxiety, some anticipation that their country is becoming the battleground between Iran and the United States?
Absolutely. If there is a single shared feeling among everyone, from top officials to even children, that is it. It is that Iraq and Iraqis are caught in this war, and Iraq is the battleground. We've seen it repeatedly over the past few weeks with attacks by Iran, attacks by the U.S., and Iraqis caught in the middle. And then at the protest, these are, again, mostly young people. And what they've been demanding, what they've been dying for, actually, literally, there have been 500 of them at least who have been killed by Iraqi security forces and militias since the protest started in October, is their slogan is basically, we want a homeland. And what that means is they want a country that is run by politicians who aren't tied to Iran, who aren't tied to other countries, who serve Iraqis. And so that battleground isn't just a very literal battleground where there are missiles raining down. It's also a political and social background in many senses. They just don't feel like this is their country.
I'm glad you reminded us that there was already a rising tempo of confrontation inside Iraq before the killing of Soleimani made it onto the international headlines. Has that been set aside, obscured, overshadowed, or in some ways strengthened by what's been going on over the last week?
The issue that is at play here and what the protests have done in an extraordinary way is kind of lay bare the Iranian influence here and what we've seen, particularly in the south of Iraq, which is predominantly Shia. It includes places that are ruled by militias. A lot of these protesters come from the south, and they're the ones who want Iran out. I mean, the thought that there have been Iranian consulates burned in the holy cities of Najaf and Karbala, is something that most of us thought we would never see. So that's been the backdrop. And it's been a real source of concern because no one's quite clear what the way out is there. It's still volatile in the south. It's volatile in Baghdad. There's a caretaker government. There's a prime minister who is now even more beholden to Iran, the one who was recommending that troops leave. And he has resigned, but he hasn't really resigned and feels like he may get his job back. So almost everything here is at play. But one thing that is certain is that that tension with Iran is persisting, and that tension over Iran is persisting.
The drone attack that killed General Soleimani, Iran's most important military leader, also killed Iraq's top paramilitary leader. It doesn't get as much attention lately. Who was Abu Mahdi al-Muhandis, and what has been the reaction in Iraq to his killing?
Well, it depends who you ask, really, but no Iraqi believes it was a good thing that the U.S. actually launched a drone strike in Baghdad, even if they hated Qasem Soleimani and even if they had hated Abu Mahdi al-Muhandis. Al-Muhandis was the deputy head of the Popular Mobilization Forces, and those are basically a compilation of former militias that came under control of the Iraqi government. They were formed in 2014 when ISIS started threatening large parts of Iraq, including Baghdad. And for those 2 months where ISIS came in and they were a little more than only 30 miles from Baghdad, it was those Iranian-backed militias who stepped up to fight. And then the Americans came in. So he oversaw this huge array of former militias, of paramilitary. Some of them answer to Iran, some of them don't answer to anyone, which is almost more worrying. And on top of the militia command, we're also talking about a great deal of money that goes into all of these militias that are nominally part of Iraqi security forces. He was also a commander of one of the main Iran-backed Iraqi militias, Qatab Hezbollah, and that is one of the paramilitary forces that is said to be one of the major sources of threat to the United States. So he's not someone who is beloved necessarily, but he was definitely Iraqi, even though backed and supported by Iran. And again, even those who hated him didn't believe that he should have been killed by a U.S. strike in Baghdad.
Jane Araf is in Baghdad. Vali Nasser is here with me in studio. Does the killing of al-Muhandis leave these militias, the ones he led, up for grabs, leaderless, or is there a smooth transition to a new military chief and really without missing a stitch?
Well, that remains to be seen. I mean, generally, if we looked at historical experience in cases like this, when you decapitate a powerful leader, you do create a scramble for a leadership. And that's actually a challenge both for Iran's Revolutionary Guards and for the PMF in order to identify a new leader. But a worst case scenario could be that if you have protracted fighting between the different factions, which sometimes can happen, which would mean violence on the streets, and it would not be good for Iraq. Or alternatively, as actually Jane alluded to, that some of the factions, you cannot assert control over them anymore. And they may go their own way and finance themselves. And I think the combination of both Soleimani and Muhandis dying probably is challenging, because had Soleimani still been there, maybe he would have been in a better position than his successor to groom a new leader and assert control. So there is risk in just the chaos that this might create.
Barbara Slavin, if you're trying to follow events from the United States, understand the implications for our country as well as for the two countries that right now are at the center of this conflict, these paramilitaries, these militias, are they just proxies for Iran? Or is there an Iraqi agenda that they also work out independent of what Tehran's desires or influence may be?
Some of them are, frankly, just mafia-type organizations that go around extorting money from people, from my understanding. Some of them, of course, were formed to deal with ISIS because Ayatollah Sistani, the preeminent leader of the world Shia, urged Iraqis to come forward to defeat ISIS when it had taken Mosul, Iraq's second largest city, and was threatening much of the rest of the country. Many of these people have been absorbed into the Iraqi security services. They're all through the army and intelligence and police. So I think it's very, very hard to generalize about them. Some of them clearly are wholly owned subsidiaries of the Quds Force of Iran. Some are not. I think the problem is that U.S. policy has put Iraq in an untenable position by leaving the Iran nuclear deal, by imposing draconian sanctions on Iran. The United States is trying to force Iraq to choose between the United States and Iran, and that's an impossible choice. And if absolutely forced to make the choice, I think Iraq will have to choose Iran because Iran is there. The United States is a fickle superpower, you know, thousands of miles away. We're increasing the tension, we're increasing the misery, and undercutting those in the country that really want a sovereign Iraq without all this influence from Iran or the United States.
Jane, did the United States attack in this way sort of bring the position of the United States in Iraq back into the debate in a way that maybe was simmering just below the surface before?
It did. It, in fact, literally put at risk the U.S. presence in Iraq, because although the Iraqis had been complaining of breaches of sovereignty, which included attacks on Iraqi air bases and things like requesting more troops, more protection for the U.S. embassy, more airspace, that Iraq didn't think was entirely justified by the reason that they're here, which is fighting ISIS. It was the audaciousness of that drone strike, which targeted an Iraqi as well as an Iranian leader and also killed six other people on the road from Baghdad airport, that made it almost untenable for politicians and political factions that were on the fence, that publicly said they didn't want U.S. troops here, but privately were saying, okay, let's keep them here, just the advisors and the trainers. It made it impossible for them to maintain that stand because it was such a blatant breach of Iraqi sovereignty that it really added a lot of fuel to that debate.
Did it put at risk, Vali, the American project in Iraq, such as it is?
Well, it potentially could. I mean, we learned nothing from our experience in Afghanistan and Pakistan when killing individuals on the ground, terrorists and civilians using drones created a tremendous amount of anti-Americanism that ultimately puts pressure on governments that we are trying to deal with. I mean, nationalism is an important factor, particularly in the Middle East, and we seem to factor that out when we think about our own priorities there. And I think the United States mishandled this issue by not taking into consideration that ultimately a stable Iraq has to have a government that is seen by its population at least to be representing the interests of that country and actually being sovereign and being treated as a sovereign entity, not as a colonial puppet by the world's most important superpower. And we have put aside all of that pretense. Even if you listen to the way we talk to Iraqis about whether they have a right or they don't have a right to ask us to stay, we on the one hand say we are there as guests. I mean, even Secretary Pompeo used this word, but we don't need to ask any permission to kill on their territory. And these obviously, particularly for Iran and Iraq, these countries that have experience with colonialism, and these issues are hot button issues, it doesn't help the Iraqi politicians to push back against the demand that the United States ought to leave.
The United States has been on the ground in Iraq. It always bears repeating, 16 and a half years. And Barbara Slavin, you've been writing about this and how this attack on Soleimani has changed the dynamic in the relationship. What did you say in your column?
Oh, I talked about all the consequences. I wrote an op-ed piece for the New York Times. They reached out to me literally an hour after the news broke that Soleimani had been killed. And I was frankly just shocked. I was stunned at the audacity of it. And then I started to consider what consequences could flow from it. And I mean, there's so many that are negative. Not, you know, this man had a lot of blood on his hands, obviously. But what comes next? So ISIS will certainly be enjoying this. You know, whether, I mean, the U.S. has already suspended its anti-ISIS operation while it works out whether its troops in Iraq and Syria are going to stay or go. NATO, which was part of this operation, also suspended its operations. I think several countries have removed troops, Canada, a few others, from Iraq already. So this helps ISIS. It could wind up entrenching Iranian influence in Iraq if the United States leaves. Iraq will be even more vulnerable to Iranian penetration, which, of course, was always the natural consequence of the U.S. invasion in 2003 and the removal of Saddam and the installation of a Shia majority government. Russia and China, I mean, Russia in particular, is just having a field day. Vladimir Putin was I think he was in Damascus. He's been talking to Erdogan about all their various projects together. He's now become the great peace broker in every place from Libya to other issues in the region, Syria, certainly. Chinese also now are considered somehow the more responsible stakeholder. The Russians and the Chinese just had joint maneuvers with Iran, maritime maneuvers. First time ever the three countries have done that, as though they're creating an alternative security arrangement for the Persian Gulf. And then I look at, of course, Iran itself. The Iranians have said that they will not observe limits on their nuclear program anymore. So the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action is practically dead. Not entirely, but practically. And Iranians who were demonstrating against their own government just a month or so ago are now forced deep underground because of this outpouring of nationalism after the assassination of Soleimani. It's very, very difficult for them to come out in the streets. They already faced enormous repression. And in this current climate, this current nationalist fervor, they're going to have to really keep their heads down. So I know the Trump administration says that this was a victory, that this was somehow good for the region and for Americans, that it makes us all safer. But I just don't see it.
Well, Jane, earlier in the program, you talked about the dynamics of things leading up to the attack. Has the killing of Soleimani and al-Mohandas pushed people back into each other's arms? Were their relationships and ongoing disaffections that showed there things were fraying between Iran and Iraq in some ways, that all of that's been put on hold by this arrival of a U.S. drone?
I think it absolutely has entrenched positions of Iran-backed groups, certainly. We're seeing that everywhere. But one of the very worrying things is that sectarianism, which had, in the past tense, for years been one of the biggest sources of conflict here, that had been waning, really. You didn't hear as much sectarian rhetoric. There weren't really sectarian-based clashes, very much more inter-Shia fighting. And the danger now is that that is resurfacing, certainly not on a grassroots level, because when you talk to young people, you know, most of them really don't care if anyone's Sunni or Shia or Kurdish. They're much more nationalist, it seems. But on a political level, that rhetoric has really heated up. And when we look at the parliament vote that demanded that U.S. forces leave, that was almost an exclusively Shia vote. In fact, the parliament speaker, who's a Sunni, actually told them, this is a Shia gathering, and I want this to be an Iraqi gathering. And that part of the parliament proceedings were actually cut from what was broadcast to the Iraqi public. That's how sensitive it is.
Vali, we're coming squarely onto your territory here. How much does this still matter? And is this something that's being taken proper accounting of in the United States? Sometimes when I hear American policymakers speak on these topics, it seems like they still don't understand what the sectarian nature of some of these admittedly international conflicts means.
I think to Jane's point, the issue has sectarianism has evolved from when it first exploded on the scene in 2006. And it's no longer an issue that's limited to Iraq. I mean, in many ways, we saw it play out in when ISIS rose to power. I mean, even ISIS was seen, at least by many Shias, as a very rigid and puritanical Sunni movement. When Qasem Soleimani rallied the youth to join the PMF movement or was able to recruit Afghans and Pakistanis to come and join militias to fight in Syria, it was to defend the shrine cities. And the images that they evoked was that of what happened in 2006 in Samarra in Iraq, where the insurgents blew up a very important Shia shrine that triggered the sectarian violence. As Jane said, when you had a case of barbarians at the gate, ISIS was 30 miles from Baghdad, was poised to come into southern Iraq, into Najaf and Karbala. I mean, and also when he was beheading Shia members of the Iraqi military as he was conquering different towns going forward, this had a very clear, I would say, sectarian element to it. And in many ways, you know, Soleimani's sort of sentiments about him in the region and even within Iran are very sectarian. I mean, if you were among the Shias in Syria or in Iraq and you thought of him as having saved you from ISIS, you liked him. But if you, on the other hand, you saw him essentially as a general on a sectarian mission, bringing Shia militias into Syria to fight for Assad and create havoc and destruction, you disliked him. And I think, you know, that issue is just below the surface. I mean, even the attitudes of Gulf states towards Iran, Iran towards the Gulf states. I mean, this has all sort of subtext of, if you would, an Arab-Sunni alliance versus a Shia Iran and its militias and its proxies, all of whom are Shia. And these Shia groups, yes, they do listen to Iran, but they also have some local interests or local fears. And I think the moment when Iraqis came out against Iranian control in Iraq, the protests that we saw in the past number of months, was really, I think, the point at which you could say they were no longer worried about ISIS or a Sunni takeover. They could now turn towards reform and actually go against these very groups that had supposedly saved the day. That whole thing may unravel. You know, if this issue keeps escalating, we may be back at some form of sectarian clash that's going to play out in Syria, it's going to play out in Lebanon, it's going to play out in Iraq, and it potentially could be back in places like Bahrain, Kuwait as well.
Well, Vali, before we talk about how sectarianism has played out in broad measure over the last two decades, maybe we could get a quick thumbnail primer on what these two groups are and why it matters and where they are.
Well, the Shias and Sunnis are the two most important divisions of Islam. Each of them has a claim to representing the true essence of Islam. But in a political context, they also are it's a form of ethnicity, if you would. And it has historical roots. In many parts of the Middle East, the Shias thought because of their faith, they were excluded from power. The Sunnis in other parts may have thought that they are not getting enough power or that they have a right to power. And in the current environment of the Middle East, where, you know, political structures have broken and states are broken, there is a fight for power and control. And the Shias and Sunnis sometimes pose as, if you would, pseudo-ethnicities, as ethnic groups, kinds of ethnic conflicts we've seen in other parts of the world. And then outsiders, of course, relate to this as they pursue their own agendas. So, you know, hardline Sunni merchants, maybe even governments began funding anti-Iran, anti-Shia fighters in Syria, they helped create ISIS, and the Sunni language was very important. And similarly, Iran has invested in the Shia militias using a Shia language very clearly in order to organize them. So it's not really a fight over religion. It's a fight over power. But religion serves, if you would, as a kind of ethnic identity here.
I sometimes see it invoked, the Sunni-Shia divide, in places where it seems to be overemphasized and then in places where it seems to be missed altogether. And I think both are mistakes, but I'm trying to help the audience develop a more subtle understanding of when it matters and when it doesn't. A lot of the early leaders of the new post-Saddam political order in Baghdad had spent much of their exile in Tehran. They were closely allied with Iran. Well, Iran and Iraq were enemies during that period. So you could either emphasize that they were often Shias, or you can emphasize that they were political enemies of Saddam and in exile. And I'm trying to tease apart which one matters and when it doesn't matter. And Barbara, you're gonna throw me a lifeline here.
Well, you know, I'm old enough to remember the whole buildup to the Iraq War and the various opposition groups that existed. I mean, basically, they fell into two major categories. There were either Kurdish groups, which had lots of grievances against Saddam for various campaigns of ethnic cleansing, some of them really quite horrible, including the use of chemical weapons. And then there were Shia. The Shia in particular, many of them, you know, had been given refuge in Iran, where even the first proto-militia was created, something called the Badr Brigade, was created during the Iran-Iraq War. You know, did these people love Iran? Many of them not. I remember even once interviewing an Iraqi ambassador in Tehran. This is a long time ago, where he was complaining about the racism of Iranians. I have an old joke. You know, the first time I went to Iran, I found out that Iranians were anti-Semitic. They hate Arabs. They look down on Arabs because of their Persian history, culture, language, and so on. So I think it's, you know, there's a love-hate relationship there as well. But Iran is the largest Shia power in the world. And if you need support against a local oppressor, there really isn't any other place to go. I mean, this even predates the Iranian Revolution. If you look at Lebanon, there was a Shia figure called the Imam Musa Sadr, who was initially financed by the Shah of Iran, went to Lebanon to help organize the downtrodden Shia Arabs in Lebanon. This man later disappeared in Libya. There are rumors that Ayatollah Khomeini had him killed because he didn't like the competition. So I think we have to be, you know, it's very hard. Look, the news media, such as it is very hard not to maintain any of these nuances when you talk about it. But you look at Iraq, you look at the fact that the Iraqi army, which was majority Shia, fought Shia Iran for 8 years, and there was very little defection from that army, even among Shias. So I think nationalism does predominate in most places, but if you, as Vali said, if you begin to threaten Shia shrines, if you start beheading people because they're Shia, people will revert to their religious identity and to their tribe, if you will, for protection. The U.S. in some ways kind of made Iraq into a sectarian place. It tried to almost duplicate the confessional system that you have in Lebanon, where various positions were given to various religious and ethnic groups. If you remember the initial coalition, the initial provisional governments that were set up by Paul Bremer back in the day, you had X number of Kurds and X number of Shia and X number of Sunni. So we kind of foisted this on a country where religious identity had not been that important for many people and where there was a lot of intermarriage.
Jane Arraf, Iran is projecting power and influence far beyond its borders. When it does it do it along sectarian lines? There are Iranian-sponsored militias in Syria and Lebanon. There are Iranian-backed forces in the Yemeni civil war. Are they all Shia or are they just Iranian allies?
I think Vali made, you know, many excellent points, but one of them was that a lot of sectarianism is about power, and that's certainly something you see here in Iraq. When you're talking about the projection of power, it does generally go along sectarian lines. If we're talking about support for the militias or support for the paramilitaries fighting to protect shrines in Syria, but not all of it. Iran has much larger ambitions than that. But one of the things here that we're seeing, particularly with a new generation of Iraqis, is that they are rejecting that. And one of the features of these protests as well has been all of these people who I've been meeting who fought with the Iran-backed Shia militias, and there are many of those people on the front lines of this protest saying, we want Iran out of here, because there is indeed a nationalism here that has intensified, I think, because of Iranian actions that Iran perhaps did not expect among the Shia population here.
The next move in your part of the world, in Baghdad, might have to do with the future position of the United States in Iraq. Is it more precarious now because of the Soleimani killing? Is there a greater chance that the United States will be asked to leave, pressured to leave, made to leave because of what's been happening over the last couple of weeks?
There absolutely is. There have been several steps taken. There's been the vote in Parliament, and the U.S. is arguing it's a non-binding agreement. That doesn't really matter at the end of the day. U.S. forces are here at the invitation of the Iraqi government, and the legal basis for those forces to be here is an exchange of letters, basically. Those letters can, and that invitation can be rescinded. The Iraqi prime minister, whose job has been on the line for quite a while to the point where he resigned, but now seems to be one of the only possible options for the foreseeable future, is also saying that he wants to start the ball rolling. He has asked for the U.S. to send a team to actually discuss the mechanism by which U.S. troops would leave. Now, the U.S. is saying basically, well, not so fast. The Secretary of State is saying essentially that there's more to discuss than that. And now it doesn't seem to be a given that the U.S. will actually leave as easily as people had perhaps thought. But that ball has definitely been sent. It's definitely been set in motion. And what we're looking at now is people scrambling for alternatives to what happens if U.S. forces are forced to leave. There are European allies, Britain, France, for instance, discussing with Iraq a possible smaller force, perhaps European-led, maybe still with U.S. forces, but a smaller footprint. But it does seem that it might have become untenable to keep 5,000 U.S. troops here under the current arrangement.
NPR international correspondent Jane Araf joining us from Baghdad. Jane, great to talk to you.
Thank you so much. Great to talk to you all.
You're listening to World Affairs, a weekly broadcast produced in partnership with KQED. I'm Philip Yun. We're talking about the recent tensions between the United States and Iran. Our guests are Vali Nasser, a former senior advisor in the State Department under the Obama administration, and a Middle East scholar at Johns Hopkins School of Advanced International Studies, and Barbara Slavin. She's director of the Future of Iran Initiative at the Atlantic Council and author of Bitter Friends, Bosom Enemies, Iran, the U.S., and the Twisted Path to Confrontation. Earlier, we heard from Jane Araf, NPR international correspondent who's been reporting from Baghdad. To hear this program or any other World Affairs episodes, you can download our podcasts on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts. Search for World Affairs, that's one word. And now back to Ray Suarez in Washington.
And turning back now to our studio guests, Barbara Slavin and Vali Nasser, President Trump for weeks was saying that he was determined to get the United States out of these conflict zones. Now is forced by circumstances to send more troops and perhaps even toughen the U.S. posture around staying in Iraq. Does he want the United States out or does he not want the United States out?
President Trump seems to be following a very muddled policy that is all things at the same time. But I think one of his instincts early on, and he said so, was to make Iraq all about Iran. He really didn't care about Iraq. In fact, at one point he went to the country and didn't let the prime minister know he's coming and just called him from a base in northern Iraq. He hasn't paid much attention to it, hasn't really courted the Iraqi leaders. And then he said at one point that the only reason the United States would stay in Iraq is to keep an eye on Iran. And now the killing of Soleimani in particular has made Iraq really about Iran. And especially now that the Iranians say the United States has to leave Iraq, it's almost like the U.S. has to defy Iran, because this is kind of like an arms wrestling between them. I don't think the United States, or particularly President Trump, particularly cares about Iraq. I mean, he could easily leave Iraq within a half an hour, just like he decided to leave Syria after a call with the president of Turkey. I don't think he has an appreciation for the strategic importance of Iraq. If he's ever had it, it was that he said that, you know, they have oil and we should have taken their oil and now they owe us money. All of which, you know, are not acceptable to Iraqis. But I think now the United States almost cannot leave Iraq just because Iranians said that they have to leave, and that would be a victory for Iran.
We're no closer to watching C-5As loading up with U.S. troops, waving goodbye to Iraqi soil.
Well, it seems not. I mean, basically, the U.S. is threatening the Iraqis that if they try to expel the American troops, the U.S. will cut off all other programs of assistance there. And even, you know, the president has threatened to sanction Iraq. And, I mean, this is a country that suffered terribly under sanctions for more than a decade after the 1991 Gulf War. You know, children starved to death. So it's a horrible thing to be threatening.
Just to be clear, what does Iraq rely on the United States for at the moment? Why is it a problem if they were to leave?
Well, it would force Iraq to be almost completely dependent on Iran. And Iraq has been trying desperately not to have that. They want to have good relations not only with the United States because they're looking for investment, you know, oil companies, that sort of thing, but also to have a better relationship with U.S. Arab allies like Saudi Arabia and the United Arab Emirates. It took the Saudis a long time to restore relations with Iraq after the overthrow of Saddam. And we've begun to see some efforts there. We actually saw the Iraqi prime minister try to act as a mediator between Iran and Saudi Arabia recently. And there are reports, according to Adel Mahdi, that Soleimani was in Baghdad to give a response from Iran to some peace feelers from the Saudis. So this puts Iraq in just a very, very difficult position. And I don't know what they will decide, but the U.S. is really playing hardball here.
I would just add to Barbara's point is that if the more the U.S. tries to intimidate Iraq and browbeat the prime minister and the parliament to rescind this decision, the more it's likely that they could touch off anger on the street. And once this issue of U.S. departure moves from the parliament to the street, or you might end up in a very different place. It's no longer then in the hands of the prime minister or the parliament to basically adjudicate this. I mean, if throngs of people in the streets start demanding this, if you have a clash with U.S. troops, if Iraqi blood is shed, there's a point at which even Ayatollah Sistani may issue a fatwa that America is no longer welcome here. And at that point, they will have to start loading C-5 planes and leave the country. And I think the U.S. is approaching this whole thing in a really heavy-handed way that is actually counterproductive.
And seems to leave Iraq with very few good choices, in the near term anyway.
Exactly. And actually undermining Iraqi politicians, publicly humiliating and embarrassing them, browbeating them, is not helping them. It only weakens them, even if they are to serve as agents of the United States standing up to demand that the U.S. stay. You're just weakening your own allies there, and that's counterproductive.
Which would seem odd if what you want to accomplish is not pushing any government in Baghdad into the arms of Tehran.
Yeah, exactly. I'm thinking in particular of the president of Iraq, Barham Saleh, who's very identified with the United States. He's a Kurd who represented the Kurdish interests for many years in the United States in the lead up to the invasion of Iraq. And how is he handling this? I mean, you know, he's considered someone sympathetic to the United States. And here the United States is committing all these acts on Iraqi soil without even prior warning.
The United States, in its most recent statements since the killing of Soleimani, has left open the possibility of conflict with Iran. Is that something that the United States should be, well, very careful about, Vali?
Yes, in a sense that the United States is relying on the notion that it can, in a direct head-to-head confrontation, it would win. And I think Iranians know that as well. The Iranians may draw some blood, hoping that would be a deterrence to the U.S. But in reality, Iran's strength is exactly in engaging the U.S. through clients, allies, what we could call low-level conflict, across a vast expanse, not just Iraq. There is Syria, there is Yemen, there is Lebanon, there is Afghanistan, for instance. And ultimately, the Iranians can play a long game. This is not for them about next week. But the question is, would the United States be really up for having large numbers of troops to fight pitch battles and put out small fires all the way from Afghanistan to Lebanon? And as I would say, this is almost like killing the United States with 1,000 cuts. And I think that in the view of the administrations, they're very reliant on America's overwhelming conventional military capabilities, which nobody doubts. But I think the Iranians are counting on the fact that the U.S. actually does not have the stamina or the interest for a prolonged commitment of this kind in the Middle East, and that the American public would not support it. And we're already seeing the mood in America is not what it was in 2002 when it comes to going to war.
Well, Barbara Slavin, where could Iran cause trouble in this broad swath of territory that goes all the way from the Gaza Strip to Oman?
Yeah, everywhere. Look, Vali mentioned Afghanistan. The U.S. has been desperately trying to get out of Afghanistan. Ambassador Khalilzad has been trying to negotiate with the Taliban. Iran has very good relations not only with the Afghan government, but with several factions of the Taliban, and I'm sure they can act, to prevent this kind of peace agreement, to make it even harder, to keep the United States mired there, or to somehow force the U.S. out if that's how they decide to play it. But they have cards to play there. And you mentioned, of course, Gaza. I mean, there are connections with Hamas, with Palestinian Islamic Jihad, Hezbollah menacing Israel. And we didn't even talk about cyber, which is a very hot topic these days, that we should look for all kinds of Iranian retaliation through cyber. They've gotten much better at this since the U.S. and Israel infected their centrifuges with something called Stuxnet about a decade ago. And people, trying to use their ATMs may have issues. There are a variety of things they could...
With attacks that originate in Tehran?
Oh, yeah. The Iranians have a cyber army that's gotten more and more proficient at these kinds of attacks. They've hacked into a dam in upstate New York. They are already, I understand, hacking into various things in Saudi Arabia. They once fried the hard drives of thousands of computers at Saudi Aramco, and this is long before they struck Aramco with drones and missiles. So it could be through cyber.
Are there other places, Vali, along with the ones that Barbara just mentioned?
Well, just impacting the global economy. Yes, President Trump says we don't need Middle East oil. But if a good chunk of the oil production goes offline or there's fear that it's going to go offline, ultimately it's going to push price of oil much higher. And that's going to impact global economy, which is already quite fragile. And even within the region, even the incident of the shooting down of the Ukrainian airliner over Tehran, whatever the reasons, wherever it happened, it brings to mind that when you have a fog of war over the Middle East, businesses, airlines, flights are not going to happen like that. People are not going to want to fly through the Middle East. People are not going to want to invest in the Middle East. Iran is only 90 miles from Dubai or from Abu Dhabi. So it's going to put a chill on international business. And that's not going to benefit UAE Qatar, Saudi Arabia, Bahrain, Kuwait, there's a reason why, as much as the Saudis are angry and unhappy with Iran, they immediately sent a senior member of the royal family to Washington to plead with President Trump not to pursue a course of war. And I think also are trying to push Iran similarly. The foreign minister of Oman went to Tehran. The foreign minister of Qatar went to Tehran. You know, if Iran and the United States really go at it, there's no way in which the smaller emirates are not going to be impacted. And that's and that, too, also will impact the global economy. A lot of money is tied to businesses there in the Middle East.
Barbara Slavin, I'm not an expert in this part of the world and don't presume to be, but I keep an eye on it and try to keep up with events. And it looks like we're dealing with two powers that are particularly allergic to being seen to back down in any conflict with any other power anywhere else in the world. They just don't want to be seen to have not responded, not punched back if they're punched. And that may be a peculiarly bad set of circumstances, given what's going on right now. So you drop a bunch of missiles on American bases in Iraq, don't kill anybody, damage a little real estate, but maybe that's not the end of it, and there's going to be more of this back and forth, which seems to be a little risky.
More than a little risky. Look, it's 40 years of bad blood between the United States and Iran, and we've had a few brief intervals under the second Clinton administration, under the Obama administration, when the two countries seemed to be moving toward a less dysfunctional relationship. Unfortunately, the Trump administration pulled out of the Iran nuclear deal, and I know that they criticized it bitterly, that it didn't last long enough, it didn't deal with enough other issues. But the fact remains that we didn't have these kinds of problems in the Middle East when the United States was still part of the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action. Iran even behaved itself for a while after the U.S. pulled out. It was only when the United States announced in May of 2019 that it was going to try to prevent Iran from exporting a single drop of oil that all of these horrible consequences began to flow from that. So, you know, the question is whether both sides can pull back from the brink. I think if the United States were prepared to offer sanctions relief, there's a possibility of some sort of multilateral process starting again to de-escalate tensions. So far, we have seen no indication that the U.S. government is willing to pull back from what it calls maximum pressure. And Secretary of State Pompeo has been particularly identified with this policy. There was a thought that he might leave and go run for Senate from Kansas, but apparently he's sticking around now. And I just don't know if the U.S. has the capacity to put anything on the table that would make it worth Iran's while to stand down. And it's not just Iran. You know, let's not orientalize this. Any country that the United States tries to squeeze, tries to bully, has a tendency to stand up and say no. North Korea, Cuba, Venezuela. It's not just Iran. These policies of extreme sanctions and pressure always backfire, it seems to me, and they just simply strengthen the most hardline elements in these governments.
But I'm wondering, Vali, if there's an aspect, and I don't want to orientalize it either, but whenever I've spoken to Iranian scholars and Iranian officials in other places in the world, since you can't talk mm-hmm. to them in the United States, there's a sense that you get that they feel disrespected, marginalized, not respected or recognized for how they see themselves as a significant power in a part of the world. They think, well, when other countries try to push us around, we have to show that we're the real deal here. And I wonder if the United States is taking account of the fact that there's this long history of Iranians feeling that they're not getting their due.
Well, I mean, Barbara actually alluded to this. The Iranians are no strangers to sort of imperial ambitions. I'm not talking about the government. I'm talking about Iranians. They have a sense of themselves, which is similar to the way maybe the Chinese think of themselves, the Indians do, or the Russians do, as a great civilization, as a head and shoulder above their neighbors, and that they look at the Middle East in the same ways as the Russians do about their neighborhood. This is our near abroad. This is the place where we should be respected and assert our control. Although it has to be said that Iran also scares its neighbors. It doesn't follow a policy of reducing anxieties about its regional presence. But if we wanted to think what's in the heads of Iranians, is that they see themselves as much more of a normal state, despite the theocracy, than the way we see them. And the sort of exceptionalism about Iran policy in the United States and Europe sort of rubs them the wrong way.
Can I just add one thing? In my book, I refer to Iran as the Rodney Dangerfield of nations. older listeners may remember that Rodney Dangerfield was a comedian who said that he never got enough respect, never got any respect. And I felt that very strongly on my trips to Iran.
So does that persist even if there's change of system or change of regime in Iran? Will that impulse of wanting to be recognized as a great power, as a great civilization, remain whether there's an Ayatollah in charge or a president or a prime minister?
Yes. In fact, there are aspects of Iran's foreign policy that are continuation of the Shah's foreign policy, except he was, I think, in many ways better at it. He got the United States to give the Persian Gulf to Iran as an Iranian lake. He got the United States to sell nuclear reactors to Iran, sell a great deal of weaponry to Iran. But the Shah had the same kinds of views about Iran's primacy in the region. And it's I think that's carried into this regime, and it will carry going forward. But I think at this particular moment, there's something else going on. I think Iranians, even average Iranians, that's why they poured in the street in the thousands and tens of thousands for Soleimani's funeral. They think this particular fight was picked by the United States, that they signed a nuclear deal, they did their part, they went out in throngs and voted for a president who would sign that deal in Iran. Even as average citizens, they did their part. And they were hopeful that not that it would solve everything, that it was an important first step. And in fact, they were happy that their government did implement the deal. And then the president came in, Trump came in, ripped the deal apart and put them under draconian sanctions. And now seems to be now ready to go even beyond economic sanctions to something much worse. So it created a tremendous sort of a anxiety, backlash, defiance in Iran, which sort of explains why all of a sudden you had such a huge outpouring. That doesn't mean they like their government or that the issues that had brought them in the streets are gone or they support hijab or they support repression. But they think that the U.S. is wrong here. I think that really runs deeply within Iranians.
There are a broader set of interests, American interests included, that would like to see less Iranian mischief-making in other countries in that part of the world. Is that fair? Is what Iran wants, let's say it was to succeed in all its ambitions, does it want a bunch of Arab vassal states on its western border? What does Iran ultimately want besides respect? Let's say Rodney Dangerfield got his respect. Yeah. What else does he want?
Well, it's so hard to disentangle defensive from offensive here. I mean, part of it is deterrence. All these militias, all these partners in the region supposedly offer Iran some deterrence against attack by Israel in particular. And also by the United States. But it is also a hegemonistic impulse. I had one Iranian newspaper publisher tell me once that Iran will not extend its feet beyond its carpets. But how big are those carpets? I mean, they're Persian carpets in a lot of places. So it's kind of deliberately ambiguous. Clearly, Iran wants as much influence as it can get without pushback. It wants trade. It wants tourism. One of the things that it got out of Iraq, it's been getting health tourism. A lot of Iraqis have been going to Iran for surgery, you know, to have their teeth fixed, this kind of thing as well. So I think average Iranians don't like to see their money spent on what they call Arab causes. But if they can see benefit to Iran in terms of trade, in terms of interactions that actually have some benefit for ordinary people, they're all for it. And they do believe Iran. Iran was an empire. It was Persia. Its influence spread not just in countries that are now Arab, but all through Central Asia as well. The Caucasus part of it was part of the Persian Empire. Afghanistan part was part of the Persian Empire. So people do have a very large sense of them. And we should remember that President Trump, when he talked about 52 sites that he was ready to hit in Iran, including cultural sites, was not only antagonizing Iranians, but the entire world. There are World Heritage, UNESCO World Heritage sites, I think something like 22 of them in Iran that are precious artifacts of humanity that go back thousands of years. So you antagonize not just the 80 million people of that country, but many others when you start threatening those sites.
Given the mutual canceling out of United States aims and Iranian aims in the region, is the world fated to never-ending conflict, Vali Nasser?
I don't think so. I'm not quite that pessimistic. I think Iran ultimately will have to get over this phase. And I think it has come very close to it. And we actually helped it during the nuclear deal to push it in the right direction. And now things ultimately cannot stay this way for a long period of time, largely because Iran cannot survive under these sanctions in its current form for a prolonged period of time. The question is, how do we transition to the next phase? Can it be a peaceful transition in the way in which the United States helped both China and Russia to sort of go from where they were to at least somewhere better? I'm not going to say to a liberal democracy, but to somewhere better. Or that we're going to end up in another Iraq scenario where it's going to be catastrophic for the United States because Iran is 80 million people. Its capital city is 2,000 miles and two mountain ranges away from the closest port facility. I mean, for the United States to think that it can militarily affect an outcome in Iran, I think is extremely myopic and delusional in that sense. And it would be catastrophic. I think it's still always better for the United States to find ways to keep nudging Iran in the right direction and open it up. And I think at some point the wisdom should be that we have to go back to where the nuclear deal was and then build other deals on top of that.
And same final question, Barbara Slavin, to take us out. Are we fated, well, at least in the midterm, to never-ending conflict?
I'm with Vali here. No, I don't think we are. You know, if we get regime change in this country and we get a president willing to return to the nuclear agreement, willing to have a respectful diplomatic dialogue with Iran, you know, there are possibilities, but it's just a terrible shame that the people of that country, people of that region have been put through this kind of trauma. And I am very worried about further instability and violence over the course of the next few months.
Barbara Slavin of the Atlantic Council, great to have you with us.
Thank you.
And Vali Nasser of Johns Hopkins University, good to talk to you as always.
Thank you.
You've been listening to World Affairs. We are more than a program. We're a nonprofit membership organization that is dedicated to engaging the public in conversations that matter. Please join our community and visit us at worldaffairs.org. This program featured Vali Nasser, a former senior advisor in the State Department under the Obama administration, and a Middle East scholar at Johns Hopkins School of Advanced International Studies. Barbara Slavin is director of the Future of Iran Initiative at the Atlantic Council and author of Bitter Friends, Bosom Enemies, Iran, the U.S., and the Twisted Path to Confrontation. And finally, Jane Araf is international correspondent for NPR. World Affairs is produced in partnership with KQED. Our technical supervisor is Jim Bennett. Our producer is Jared Sport, and our executive producer is Joanne Jennings. I'm Philip Yun. Thank you for joining us.